Okay, so let's start. And welcome to a new semester and some new courses. So my name's Steve Reynolds. You can find my details on the web. And this course is called Informatics 2B. And it's about data. And what is it really about? So it's in sort of two threads that don't really intertwine so much. One thread, which is taught by KK, is the algorithms and data structures thread. And I'll be teaching the other thread, which I'll call learning and data. So sort of the commonality is supposed to be data. Algorithms and data structures is all about the design and the analysis of correct and efficient algorithms and how you can analyze algorithms in terms of their running time. I've never used this lecture theatre before. Is like the volume about right for people at the back and so on? Yeah? Okay. And the learning of data half is a little bit different in that it's not so much about analyzing the, well, it is to an extent about analyzing the algorithms that run on data you have, but what you're really interested in is making predictions about the future, because that's the most interesting thing to predict, and making predictions about data that we haven't seen. So that's in a couple of thumbnails what this course is about. And if you want to tell the difference between us, KK has a slightly longer beard than me. Okay, there's a web page, of course. Everything's there. I managed to get my act together this year, and I printed out a set of notes, which you may or may not have picked up yet from the ITO. I suddenly realized at lunchtime today that given the supposed size of this group, there was probably, I don't know, probably several thousand sheets of paper involved bringing it here. So I figured we could have a distributed algorithm and you could kind of collect it from the ITO and bring your own personal copy. And I hope that works. I guess today, because it's an introductory lecture, is perhaps the least technical of all the lectures, but there's some technical stuff coming up. So it's not a disaster if you don't have the notes with you. You might find it useful to try and bring the notes with you to each lecture, because who knows, you might want to make annotations to the notes. The other thing I should add is that if there's something that turns up in a lecture that isn't in the notes, unless bizarrely I say it's nothing to do with the course, it's part of the course, it's part of the syllabus. If something turns up in a tutorial that doesn't seem to be in the notes, although it probably will have been, it's part of the syllabus. So the notes, you shouldn't regard the notes as some sort of complete text for everything and anything. It does cover most things. But in particular, I could imagine putting in some extra examples and things like that aren't in the notes. But they get pretty good coverage. And if you're super keen, you can read through them tonight and relax and enjoy the lectures. What else can I say about the course? There's three lectures a week. You know this. You can all read it on the web, but I'll say it. There's three lectures a week. Please turn up to the lectures. You might find them useful. You might find them beneficial in your learning experience. If you don't, let me know. Let KK know, because that's useful for us as well. Because you know, it's actually supposedly for your benefit I'm doing this rather than for my personal benefit. Even more, there's tutorials. You should all be assigned to a tutorial group. I think they were issued quite early this year, so you should have had a chance to kind of shift around in case you had to be at KB or something for your particularly originally allocated tutorial. Please attend tutorials. If you want to just do it on a value for money basis, when I'm giving a lecture, there's supposedly 192 of you, although unless some of you are, I don't know, there's probably about 120 in here, but anyway. When I'm giving a lecture, you can regard my attention as easily sliced up, you're getting like 1% of the lecturer. If you go to a tutorial where there's typically, I don't know, 8-10 people in it, you're getting 10, 12% of the person who's given the tutorial. You get a chance to ask questions. You get a chance to say, I didn't understand this. And it's completely fine to go to a tutorial and say, I didn't understand this, please explain. That's kind of what they're there for. It's completely not very good if the tutorial ends up with the tutor ending writing stuff on the board and it becomes like another mini lecture. So please go to tutorials and please prepare beforehand for tutorials and work through the questions and read through the notes. I know stuff, it may seem, well, it's coursework, there's this, there's that, but it actually is worthwhile doing it because it's actually one of the better opportunities that you get in this course to actually talk about the issues in the course that you want to talk about. What else? Coursework. There is some. It will be fun. You will enjoy it. And there will be two pieces. It's a very exciting year for us because normally we do courseworks like you kind of interleave coursework between Inf2B and Inf2D, and normally we came first and Inf2D came second. For a reason that escapes me, we appear to be second this year, so that's very exciting. And I've got written down this bit of paper, which I hope is the same as is on the web, that the first one will come out round about the first week of February, maybe the 10th, and the second one round about the first week of March, end of the first week of March, and you'll get at least a couple of weeks to do the courseworks. There'll be a TA assigned to each half of the course who will be concerned with the coursework, and there'll be like kind of drop-in sessions if you need any help or advice or have questions about the coursework. And more of that at the time of the coursework. Again, you should have kind of got this into your system after a semester, but remember coursework is assessed in terms of marks in second year. Yeah, you've got a question.
Sorry?
No, tutorials start next week because a lot of them are like 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock on a Monday morning, and it would have been insane to have had a tutorial right before the lectures. So lectures, I think, go from week one through to the end of week 10. There could be possibly one in week 11 because of a careers talk, I can't remember. Tutorials definitely go through week two through to week 11, so there's 10 tutorials. So even though lectures have stopped, you may yet have a tutorial, so please try and remember that as well. Anything else? Coursework, it does count. You get each coursework's worth 12.5% of the mark, 25% of your total mark. So it's worth working hard on the coursework. In particular, if you don't do the coursework and end up getting a very low mark, like under 25%, you failed the course. We don't have resits for coursework, so you'll be back enjoying Inf2B again next year. So please, please, please do the coursework. And try and organize your time for that. Okay. Books. There isn't really a required textbook for Inf2B. KK can talk about his side of the course. For my side of the course, there's a whole bunch of books here, but it's one of these areas where the good ones are quite advanced, and you might find it pretty heavy going. They do require at least mathematical confidence, The Whitman Franke book is not bad, and it's also used in third year courses. This is an excellent book, but quite advanced. And this is an O'Reilly book, and it's kind of fun, but only intersects with about 15% of the course. You know, please don't talk while the lecture's going on. It's really, really annoying, and I'm reasonably easygoing, but it does annoy me when people talk in the lecture, you know? What else? Wikipedia. Some of the entries are quite good, actually, in this area. But it's like all of Wikipedia. You kind of have to treat with caution. Okay, so let's get onto business. Like I said, we've got some data. What do we want to do with it? And a lot of the ADS half of the course is about how we can efficiently sort it and how we can efficiently search for things in it. And I guess in first year you'll have come across things like binary search and so on. And a lot of the work in the ADS thread is looking at how we can analyze the running time of algorithms, how we can analyze the worst case runtime and the average case runtime. In the learning half, what we're interested in is making predictions about new data. And to some extent, that's kind of involves trying to build a model of the data. So building a model of the data means you've made all these observations about whatever data it is you're looking at. You might be doing handwriting recognition. You might be trying to predict the weather or predict the stock exchange or something like that. And given this data, you'd like to make a model so that you can make a prediction for, well, the circumstances I'm in, what's going to happen? So what are the circumstances you might be in? Well, you might be given a handwritten character or some image of a handwritten character, and you'd like to say whether it's A, B, C, D, or so on. You might want to know what the weather is going to be tomorrow given the previous day's weather. So those are the sort of that's the sort of context you have, and then given that you'd like to make some prediction. And to do this we use a model. So the sort of predictions. So I'm using prediction in a very broad sense here. The sort of predictions that we might want to make are things like classification. So can we assign a data item to its class? So this is like the handwriting recognition task. Can we, if you've got handwritten digits, can you assign this particular image to a particular class of digit? Is it 0 or 1 or 2? Can we predict the next item in a sequence? This is, you know, the kind of classic sort of example of things like, you know, currency rate prediction or something like that, just based on the time sequence. Can you predict what it's going to be at the next time click? A very general thing is, can we predict an output given a new input? So this is, you know, like, can we predict a real number given some particular set of numbers? So we'll start looking at that, at a particular example of that sort of thing towards the end of today when we look at the idea of recommender systems. So you're on Amazon, so your input is like your purchase history or your browsing history. So given that, can we predict what rating you're going to give to some new DVD or something like that? And then there's also a more sort of generic type of task, which is can we sort of somehow infer some kind of structure from the data? So, for example, we might like to group similar items together, and that general thing is called clustering. Okay, I thought. Let me give you a couple more bits of motivation before we get going. So, in a sense, what we're interested in this sort of course is developing intelligent systems or developing computer programs that seem to display some aspect of intelligence, which are able to adapt to data they receive, are kind of robust to different types of data. So they recognize my handwriting, they recognize your handwriting, and they recognize her handwriting, and so on. Intelligent, let's not even go there. But we'd like some sort of approximation to whatever you might think of as intelligent behavior. So the question is it possible to get such behavior by carefully programming things by hand? And in some cases it may be, but in most cases and in most real world cases, it's very hard to do this. So if you want a robot which can kind of navigate sensibly and autonomously, you know, even just around a building, let alone around, you know, Edinburgh or something. It's kind of hard. In fact, it's very, very difficult to come up with something that can have robust behaviours just by programming by hand. And the approach of learning from data is that we want computer systems to learn how to act, to learn how to predict, and action is related to prediction, and in this course we're just sort of concerned with prediction, based on observations of hopefully many, many examples of the behaviour we're trying to predict. So again, if we go and think in terms of handwriting recognition, then the many, many examples are just examples of people who've written digits, which you might get from anywhere. If you're the post office, maybe you take a photograph of every letter and every envelope with an address on it, and get the data from there. If you're doing speech recognition, maybe you record things. I don't know. Record news programs off the television, or record people having telephone conversations. So that's what learning from data is. And in fact, and this will become apparent what I really mean by this is that in many cases. We actually come in with a framework, but quite a flexible framework, and the job of learning is to estimate the parameters from the data. So we come in with a basic form of a model, and then we want to estimate the parameters for that model. And that might involve doing things like computing statistics from the data we've seen, like kind of mean values and variances or things like that. Or it might be involved in something a little bit more elaborate. So one of the reasons, or one of the things that we really care about when we do this is that we need to accept and base our approaches on the fact that we're operating under uncertainty. And by this I mean, well, we're making queries about previously unseen data items, new data items. You're always working with limited information. So if you've got a robot trying to navigate its way around some environment, it won't have a complete map of the environment. It's just got what its sensors are telling it. So you're always working with limited information. Again, you've got the robot. Its sensors may not always be correct. You may have some blurring or occlusion in a video camera. So, you know, if I'm here, I can't tell what's under the table because I've, you know, there's an opaque surface between me and underneath. If I'm recording something by a microphone, there may be competing sounds. And also many of the things we're looking at are basically by nature quite statistical in the way and there is some sort of implicit variation. So when you kind of write by hand, you may have, you know, because of things like muscle tremor and so on, and the surface you're writing on, you're not going to write the same letter the same way every time. So we want models that can take account of these variations of these uncertainties, and that's why probabilistic methods turn out to be quite powerful for these tasks, because probability is the way to deal with uncertainty, and it's the way to deal with these uncertain situations to a large degree, more so than methods based in logic. Okay, and so what sort of data are we looking at? I mean, basically, one of the real powerful things about this whole learning from data paradigm is that the sorts of data that it's been used to apply, that it's been applied to, has widened considerably over the past 10, 15, 20 years. So maybe 20 years ago, the sorts of things you used these probabilistic methods, these machine learning methods for, were things like speech recognition, things like image recognition, things like character recognition, where you're taking data in through sensors like cameras and microphones. And then we start to look at other forms of data, so we can look at sort of social and economic records, so we might want to predict currency exchange rates, predict prices, whatever, predict things about the way we live. Then increasingly in the last 10, 15 years, a huge, huge amount of machine learning has been done on stuff like web data. So, you know, the company, the Googles and the Yahoos of this world will try to learn things about the behavior, and they can learn quite detailed models about behavior based on what you click, what pages you view, how long you stay on a page, and things like that. And you may well want to kind of use these processes to optimize certain things. So you might want to optimize page design, advert design, to maximize the sort of click through or something like that. Google take this to quite extremes, where they will use machine learning approaches to basically optimize what the right font size should be on a particular web page, optimize what the right font to use is, by trying to kind of maximize the click-throughs perhaps, or whatever, because of course they're always interested in just maximizing the income. And then other things you might want to do is to actually use machine learning on stuff that I'll call artificially created data. You looked at ways of doing parsing in INF2A, if you did INF2A. Over the past few years, there's been an intense amount of work in using machine learning approaches to rank parsers and to find the best possible parse of a natural language sentence. Mike O'Boyle's group in this school have generated extensions to compilers like GCC, which are based on machine learning, and learn the best possible transformations to object code, again based on the data and using machine learning approach to make models based on that data. So this is really widening the area, the areas which machine learning's infected. So again, 20 years ago, it was primarily stuff just for the sort of classic perceptual AI problems, let's call them that. These days, machine learning, I think, has an impact on nearly all of computer science, and it's increasing. So it's worth knowing about. So before I get on to the main example today, I just want to kind of look at how we might process some data and use this to kind of motivate the idea of working with high-dimensional vectors. So this is an example of some handwritten digits that were collected by a guy called Alex Sievold, and you can go to his website, I guess it's still there, and download this data. This is interesting data just to look at because it shows you the sort of problems that you have. So you can see this is written in a more European style. So you're going to have these ones with big heads on and croft and loopy sevens and things like that. But you can see that there's really quite a lot of variation. If you go and look at the way the kind of numeral eights are written, they can vary a lot. There's that up there, which I can barely see if it's a, I think it's a zero, but it could be a six. There's that sort of thing now, which I guess is just a seven. So you can see there's a lot of variations. There's a lot of variations in the data. There's that thing now, which is probably a five. And there's a funny looking eight there. So there's lots of variations in the data. And if you imagine you want a machine to recognize this, you can start to see that even recognizing handwritten digits from 0 through to 9, and they're all nicely segmented for you, each one's in its little box, is not a straightforward problem. It really isn't a straightforward problem. So if we want to look at how we might process the data, so this is taking one of the eights, I think it's probably that eight there. So we take one of the eights and we get the image for an eight. And what we'd like to do is to get this data in a form that we can process by our machine learning methods. Now there's various approaches you could do. I mean, one thing you could do is you could try and extract features. So you might like to look for when you've got turning points of the curve, when maybe we get a cross, looking for things that are approximately vertical lines as opposed to well, less vertical, I wouldn't say horizontal, and so on. So you could try and extract features, and that's a perfectly valid way to start addressing the problem. But another way to address the problem is just to overlay the numeral on a grid. And in this case, we have an 8x8 grid. And each kind of box in the grid, we really just want to see what kind of pen activity there's been in that box. So the first thing we had to do was to do some kind of segmentation. So we've got to take the image, we've got to take the sub-image of the actual numeral from the overall image. And then we scale it so it fits in this 8x8 box. And you can get segmentation errors, so there's a bit of a cutoff at the bottom and on the top there. We can represent it as a grid. So what do we then want to do? Because at some point we want to switch to some kind of numerical or possibly symbolic representation. Well, one thing we could do is just represent the grid in binary. So what we've done here is we've just taken for each grid location, we've just looked at the amount of ink in it, and you know, based on some threshold or something like that, if it's more than half black or something like that, we'll call it a 1. Otherwise, we'll call it a 0. And then we can represent this image as this kind of binary grid. It's a bit low resolution. You can still kind of make out the 8. But it gets harder to do that, and I would expect that you would find it, if you were presented with a lot of grids like this, you would personally, without the aid of a computer, start to find it quite hard to do the image recognition. And we can convert this to a 64 element vector. So there's two things worth talking about when we have this very simple little line convert to a 64-element vector. The first thing is that if you're asked, well, what dimensionality do we work in when we're doing handwritten digit recognition, you might reasonably say, well, we're working in two dimensions because you draw digits on the flat piece of paper, you've got x and y coordinates. And sure, you can do that, and you can sort of come up with some x, y coordinate map of that, which you might use to kind of graphically represent the image. But what we've done here is, rather than thinking of it in two dimensions, we've quite arbitrarily chopped up the image into 64 pieces, and we're saying each one of those is a dimension of the problem. So we're now working in a 64-dimensional space. But don't worry, most things you knew about 2-3 dimensions kind of carry forward to 64 dimensions or whatever number of dimensions. So that's a big deal. We've gone from what you were thinking of as working 2 dimensions, and we're now working with a 64 element vector. The other thing about doing this is that going to the 64-element vector, well, if you know the rules, if you know the 64-element vector corresponds to an 8x8 grid, you can go back to that. But just putting it as the vector, you kind of lose some of the structure of the grid. So, for example, you've got this vertical line. You've got all ones, these 6 ones in a vertical line. And that structure is not at all obvious from the 64-element vector. So that seems to be a bad thing. The reason we do this is that we can start to do some kind of straightforward mathematical operations, like take the distance between two 64-element vectors to do processing on things. So we'll come back to this, but I guess one of the main messages is just be relaxed about high dimensions. Another thing we did is that when we made this representation, we did a rather arbitrary thing. Well, we did many arbitrary things. We divided it into a grid, and then for each grid element, we set it to either 0 or 1. You could set each location to be a real number between 0 and 1. So depending on the amount of black ink in each grid location, you give it a number. So, you know, this is like 000.02, because presumably there's about 2% black ink up to about 78% there, and so on. And that gives us some more information, and that information would help us get back to something like that, rather than the kind of blocky version the binary grid would give us. It's still a 64-dimensional vector. It's just that we've no longer constrained the elements to be 0 or 1. Okay. And we call these things feature vectors. So feature vectors are basically just the kind of general term for how we represent the inputs to our system. Okay. So at this point, I have a question for you. Do you have any questions for me? Or do you have any answers for me? So if we were to use a 100 by 100 grid versus an 8 by 8 grid, what are the pros and cons of that? Just say, yeah?
It would be a lot harder to work with because it's 100,000
values. That's very true. That's very true. Yep, that's both a good pro and a good con. Do you or somebody else want to tell me why it's going to be harder to work with because there's 100,000 values? 10,000, right? Yeah. Anyone want to tell me why it's harder? Yeah?
More memory and also operations on it would take longer.
More memory and more arithmetic operations. Yeah, that's true. Any other reason? I know what you're saying. Yeah, that's a very good point. So one of the issues. Those are all excellent spot on points, and they're all very interrelated. So the thing is about if you're doing an 8x8 grid, you're working 64 dimensions. So there's a lot of possible vectors. It's a 2 to the 64. If you think binary is still a huge number, but it's a lot smaller than 2 to the 10,000. So if you think of the sort of if you just sort of think of the space of possibilities, there's a lot more possibilities when you have a 100 by 100 grid. So you're going to need a lot more examples of digits to start to sort of work out where in this huge dimensional space eights lie and sixes lie and twos lie and so on. As you get to these higher dimensions, you need basically more training examples to constrain what you're doing. We'll come back to that. What I want to do now is to think about similarity. And this is of course one of the key things when you're doing any kind of machine learning, any kind of pattern recognition. You'd like to actually be able to quantify, to measure how similar two things are. So if you're looking at handwritten characters, you want to know how similar things are because you hope one eight is more similar to other eights than it is to sixes or fours or whatever. And you can think of, if you could take a distance between two vectors, you could think of a distance as corresponding to dissimilarity, and some we'll talk about it next time, but some sort of, if you like, some sort of inverse function of the distance corresponding to similarity. So what I want to do for the next 15 minutes in the next lecture, I'll talk about Euclidean distance. You know about Euclidean distance, right? Euclidean distance, if we, let's see if I can do fancy things with the lights here. Nope. Oh well, failed dismally. Ah. That is so counterintuitive because it actually gives you a picture of the thing on the screen and everything else is a touch screen. So you assume that by touching the kind of panel 3 there, it'll make the lights go to the, on the board and so on. But no, you have to go to this thing here and it is in fact just a picture of the switch. And the reason you know it's a picture of the switch, you can't see, but you can imagine it's a light switch. It's got two screws holding the switch into the panel. And the picture of the switch is quite accurate, so it does have those two screws on the picture, which I think is the cue to tell you this is not a touch screen anymore. Every other time it's a touch screen, but now, it's telling you to go there. Okay. Well, I like that sort of thing anyway. We've got two vectors. Call them x and y. Actually, let me go here. You can probably read it there. So we have x. It's two vectors, which has components x1 and x2. These are two-dimensional vectors, components y1 and y2. Let me tell you a bit of notation I use a lot in the notes, and it's nothing to get concerned about, but I will often write these things as like a row vector transposed. So these two things are the same, because we think in terms of column vectors. It's really, really annoying to write column vectors when you're writing text, right? So you want everything to be on a line, so we just write things as a row vector with row vector transpose. So that's no big deal. And let's just look at the Euclidean distance between these two things. So I'll call it R2. The 2 is simply because we go and have a squared measure when we take the Euclidean distance. And you've seen this before. We just do it component by component. Oops. X2 minus Y2 all squared, and you take the square root. Now consider you've got the case when, in fact, you've got a vector A, which sort of goes from A1 all the way down to AD. So we're looking at our 64-dimensional vectors. And you have a vector B going from B1 down to BD. We can straight away just kind of generalize our expression for Euclidean distance. And we do exactly the same sort of calculation, except we do it over all the dimensions. So we take a sum from over the d dimensions, and the summation index is I. So it's just like that. So we're just taking the square root of that. So we can take Euclidean distance. So this is a useful thing because it enables us to take distances of vectors in a high dimensional space. Okay. So what I want to talk about now is recommender systems. So when you go on Amazon, you kind of log onto the Amazon website, and it says something like, "Steve, I have recommendations for you." Actually, it says to me, "S, I have recommendations for you." And 2 years ago, because this slide is 2 years old, gave me a set of recommendations like this, which are a kind of weird and wonderful mix of things. So the question is, how does, and everybody's had the experience. So sometimes Amazon gives you kind of reasonable but really boring recommendations. I don't know, it recommends Neil Young, and you've bought like kind of 25 Neil Young CDs in the past years, so that's not so hard to get. Other times it's like, how did it know I would be interested in this new thing? The methods I'm going to look at and talk about are actually really simple, but actually scarily close to what these systems do for real. And it's sort of one of these things that these really, really simple methods can actually work quite powerfully when you have a lot of data. So what we're going to do, we're going to build our own mini recommender system, and because I'm not Amazon, I don't have access to people's shopping and browsing history. What I do have access to is metacritic.com, which is a fine website, and you can get critics' views on movies, amongst other things. And many critics of movies will give star ratings, whether it's one star or five star or scores out of 10 or whatever. So we have 6 critics who are American critics. I'm trying to remember what publications they write for. This person writes for Rolling Stone. He writes for LA Times. She writes for USA Today. I think he writes for the Wall Street Journal. He's quite famous. I think he writes for Variety. Has anybody heard of David Denby? He's utterly escaped me who he writes for. Any Americans in the house who can tell me who David Denby is?
New Yorker.
New Yorker? That's plausible. Is that correct? Oh, cool. Okay. Why am I like so stuck in like the 1980s when you guys are kind of so far ahead of me? Okay. Okay. Does he still look like that? Okay. Right. And about 2 years ago, these were films that were being reviewed. It's actually quite interesting because you completely forget about these films. So Australia was a film which I never saw. I think it starred Nicole Kidman and I don't know who saw Australia.
Hugh Jackman.
Okay. This one, Body of Lies, which had Russell Crowe and Leonardo DiCaprio. I've completely forgotten that one as well. I think. Anyway, Burn After Reading was a Coen Brothers movie. That was okay. Revolutionary Road was a very targeted at the Oscars type of movie. Milk was really pretty cool. And out of all those movies, if you haven't seen any of them, you should go and see Milk because it's really cool. And Hancock was kind of, you know. Okay, so that's the... I'm not going to act as your movie critic, but these guys do act as your movie critic. So this is our data, and we're going to present our data as a grid. So what we've got is we've got this 6x6 grid. It's pure coincidence that I happen to have chosen the same number of critics as the same number of films. It doesn't matter, but I have in this case, and it fits nicely onto a slide, which is probably why I did it. So we've got this grid, and for each box in the grid, we can say, well, Denby scored Australia 3. Morgan Stern really, really hated Hancock and scored at 0. Peter Travers loved Milk and gave it a 10, and so on. So given this sort of data, what sort of things might you want to know? Now, if you're Amazon or Netflix or whoever, or, you know, even Cineworld, I guess, these things are still films, but these critics, don't think of them as critics, think of them as customers with money in their pocket. And what you want to do is you want to take the money out of their pockets and put it in your pocket. And the way you want to do that is by giving them offers that they didn't even know they wanted, and your competitors can't give such good offers. So they'll keep on coming back to you because before they even knew it, you could tell them that they wanted to see Hancock. That's the game. So the sort of things that you want to do to be able to do this, if you're Amazon or whoever, and I should add, I'm just using Amazon because it's the most famous one, and there's no sponsorship or recommendation implied here. The sort of things you want to do is you'd like to know how do movies go together, which movies are similar. And how do customers go together? Which customers are similar? And the thing about this is that, you know, I don't really care if I'm Amazon. The only aspect, assuming that your credit card is good, the only aspect I really care about is what things you buy from me. You know, I don't care if you're male or female, you know, British or Venezuelan, whatever. All I care about is what you buy. So the information I have about you for customer Denby, I just know. Well, I have these ratings in this case. For Amazon, it might be much. You might have much less data. You might just know that it was a buy, a no buy, or perhaps you got some browsing information. So you looked at it and then decided to buy something else. So for Denby, I've got these ratings for these movies, and this is my knowledge of Denby. So my complete profile of Denby is in fact 374997, and that's what I know about this person. And of course, I can be a big evil corporation, put lots of other things together, and you know, foolish enough to shop on some kind of fancy smartphone that goes and gives location information and all that, and so on. But this is just the information I know about Denby. It's just these numbers. And the information I know about Australia, well, of course, You know, I sell films, so I know a lot more about Australia, but for the purposes of this task, the information we have about Australia is that Denby gave it a 3, McCarthy gave it a 7, and so on, and Travers gave it a 5. So I just have these rating scores. So one way I can look at things, I might want to go and look at, well, how similar are the critics, how similar are the users? And for that, we can think of a review space. So this is basically plotting, this is basically placing the users in a space according to the reviews of a film. And to start with, we'll just do it in two dimensions. And we'll place our reviewers in a space defined by their rating for Hancock and their rating for Revolutionary Road, which was that Kate Winslet, Leonardo DiCaprio movie. And we find that we can place them here. So Morgan Stern hated Hancock, didn't like Revolutionary Road very much. This side sort of liked Revolutionary Road, didn't like Hancock. Travers likes everything, so on. So this is starting to be able to place data items in a review space, and maybe we get a new user come along, who it turns out rates Hancock 2 and Revolutionary Road 7. What can we say? What can we say about that user? Well, one thing we can do is we can go and look at the distances of that user to all the other users, just in this two-dimensional space, and we'll use our familiar Euclidean distance calculation. So we can see in this case, you can see just by looking here, that the closest critic to this new user is critic McCarthy. We can compute the Euclidean distance between them. It turns out just to be root 2, because they were both just kind of one score different in each dimension. So we can compute a distance between the user and every one of these critics. So we can go ahead and we can go and build a matrix. It's actually, of course, it's symmetric because the difference between Denby and McCarthy is the same as the difference between McCarthy and Denby. So you would really only need, you know, the top half of this matrix, but whatever. I've shown it in its full glorious symmetry, and we can compute the distances. In this case, the distances between all the critics. So we can see the closest pair are Turan and Puig. And Travers and Puig are pretty close, as are Turan and McCarthy. So these are just computed this time in 6 dimensions, and we're just taking Euclidean distances in those 6 dimensions. Little note about Euclidean distances is that very often when you're just comparing things, you don't need to take the square root in the Euclidean distance. You can just work with the squared Euclidean distances. Squaring is a monotonic function, so the rankings are going to be the same. Finally, we might have another user coming along, and they give some scores to 6 to Body of Lies, 9 to Burn After Reading, 6 to Revolutionary Road, and we can compute the distance of that user, this new user, from our database of users, and we find we get some distances like that. And well, what we can say is that user 2 looks to have preferences closer to Puig than to Denby. But you're not saying user 2 is identical to Puig. You might want to get some kind of weighting, where you go and put more weight on the ones who are close, like Puig and Turan, and less weight on the ones who are further away, like Denby. And I think that's where we'll stop today. It's a minute to 5. What we're going to look at next time is how, based on these intuitions of working in this idea of a review space, we can start to recommend films and cluster films and so on. So Tuesday that will be, next week.
Christ.